Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming back so promptly. It's now 20 to 12, so we'll resume, and we're on agenda item 4.2, which is part of the section of the agenda today on air quality. 4.2 is in relation to the updated air quality assessment that the applicant submitted at deadline 2, and our question is to the applicant, which is in relation to whether that updated air quality assessment considers emissions from cruise liners going to and from Enderby Wharf and cruise liners that are parked or stationary at Enderby Wharf. If not, why not? Mr. Humphreys, thank you.
Madam, thank you. Michael Humphreys. Mr. Pyatt will obviously deal with this particular one.
Stephen Pyatt. The updated air quality assessment was undertaken with the same methodology approach as the previous assessment. In the updated assessment, we used the most recent DEFRA emission tools and background maps. And the background maps that DEFRA publish incorporate all the background components that we need to add to our modelled roadside component. And it's the background maps are split into various sectors. So there's industrial, residential type emissions, and a category called other, which includes ships. So there is an allowance in the background maps for those types of emissions. We've also, as part of the background into undertaking the assessment, reviewed the environmental statements for the Enderby Wharf in relation to both the movements and the stationary emissions. And even if the backgrounds didn't fully consider that development, it wouldn't make a difference to our assessment. The movements in the environmental statement were screened out as needing an air quality assessment because they didn't trigger the number of movements that's stated in the guidance, the local air quality management technical guidance. The emissions from the stationary ships at the wharf were modelled, and the impacts were very localised around the actual wharf itself. The receptors that we've modelled in that area, we have mainly an imperceptible change at those receptors. So if the background was slightly higher in those locations, it wouldn't have a bearing on the outcome of the assessment.
Madam, can I just get Mr. Pyatt to clarify for the avoidance of doubt? He was talking about the environmental statement. Can you just clarify which environmental statement you're talking about?
Yes, so the air quality assessment in relation to the stationary emissions was the Royal Haskinen assessment in 2015. That was undertaken in 2015.
This is, Madam, the Enderby Wharf environmental statement. So there was a lot of data in the Enderby Wharf environmental statement about the environmental effects of that scheme, which one can see from that document, are very localised around the area of that scheme. And so taking into account their environmental statement of what their effects are, what's the chance of there being a material cumulative effect between the two?
Stephen Pyatt, yes, so there's no impact on our scheme because the changes as a result of our scheme won't change. And, like I say, the receptors that we've modelled closest to the Enderby Wharf are below the air quality objectives. And like I say, there's no change as a result of the scheme, so there wouldn't be any impact in terms of cumulative.
Thank you, Mr. Pyatt. If you were reviewing the ES for Enderby Wharf, that would have been written whilst the applicant was trying to get the permission for that facility. Does the ES reflect actually what is happening there at the moment? Have there been any further changes, say, to the number of boats over and above the level that was assessed at the time of the ES production?
I'm not aware of any changes from the environmental statement or the air quality assessment that accompanied that, and any changes to the wharf since it's operational.
Thank you, Mr. Pyatt. Peter?
In a sense, it's a tangential point. I just want to check. You said in the updated air quality assessment you used the DEFRA tools. Now, just before the break, you referred to the adjustments that you had made. So you were really only meaning the background kilometre square data from DEFRA, not their actual... because they actually haven't updated the toolkit yet themselves, have they? You were using Highways England material.
No, we still use the DEFRA tools. So we use all the DEFRA tools to model the concentrations and predict the concentrations in the future. It's just we use the interim advice note in 170 that takes the DEFRA modelled concentrations and uplifts them. Right. So you still need to use...
So it's adjusted DEFRA tools.
Yes.
So it was the fact that you didn't say adjusted DEFRA tools. Yeah. I was just wanting to check that we weren't going back on what previously said.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Keen to push on, so if we can maybe wait for any potential responses from the host borough until at the end of the air quality section, I'd be grateful. So thank you for that, Mr. Pyatt, in which case if there's nothing else from my colleagues here, can we move on to a similar question to the applicant, 4.3, which is why does the applicant consider that the contribution to NOx and PM levels from river barges is likely to be not significant, which was the quote from paragraph 6.6.11 of your updated chapter 6. Thank you, Mr. Humphreys.
Thank you, Madam. Michael Humphreys. I think Professor Laxon is going to deal with this one.
Yes, Madam. Duncan Laxon. The reference you give is to Chapter 6. The barges were considered more fully in Appendix 6.A to the ES, App 049, and that's on pages 25 to 28. So we gave some detailed consideration to barges.
Do you have the library document reference for that appendix?
APP 049. In that document, there is a table 10 on page 25, which sets out the movements, transport movements for the entire construction period. And in very broad terms, this is dealing with both river and road transport movements, with a roughly half going by river, half of the materials going by river, half by road. And it's clear from that table that there are far more lorry movements than barge movements. In very broad terms, and you can look at the table for details, 4,000 barge movements over 4 years and 130,000 lorry movements over the 4 years. And so clearly, without those barge movements, there would have been an additional 130,000 lorry movements on the road that we would have had to consider. The barge movements, and I should clarify that when I talk about barge movements, the barges themselves don't cause any emissions. It's the tugs that are pulling the barges, so I will treat them synonymously in what I'm saying. The barge movements equate to an average of fewer than three per day over this four-year construction period. And there is evidence in another document, which is APP 054 on page 37, that there are around 17 tug movements a day on the river, together with many more movements of smaller ferries plying up and down the river. So we're talking about an increase associated with Silvertown of around 3 on to a total of around 17 at the moment. So it's a very small increase that's being talked about. To help understand the significance of that, there are background maps of concentrations, which we've just heard referred to by Stephen Pyatt. And if we look at that information, it shows that the existing movements of all the existing tugs and other ships on the Thames contribute about 0.5% to the background concentrations in a grid square, both for nitrogen dioxide and for particulate matter. So if we're going to make an increase, which I've shown is very small, it's a small increase on what's a small contribution, and it's information like that that's led us to conclude that the impacts from the tugs and barges will be insignificant. It should also be noted in that context that part of our conclusion there is reached because the tugs are well away from receptors, in contrast to lorries, which end up travelling sometimes a few metres away from receptors. And just in case it's raised, the tugs use gas oil to fuel their engines, and this is a low sulphur fuel, so the sulphur dioxide emissions will be minimal, and there's no evidence that sulphur dioxide from the tugs would be significant, and so that again is not an issue. And the final point I would make is that the barges are actually just going to be a temporary thing, because it's a temporary source, because they only apply during the construction period.
Thank you. Okay. In that case, can we move on to the next item on the agenda, which is 4.4, which is asking whether Royal Borough of Greenwich is satisfied that the impacts of emissions from barges that would use the Greenwich jetty, as they were screened out as not significant in the updated Chapter 6. Greenwich, do you have a response?
Kim Smith, Royal Greenwich. At the moment, we don't have any commitment by TfL to use of the river from the south side site. It's a cumulative amount of river movement, which could effectively be accommodated totally on the northern site. The indicative number of barges which are shown in TfL's documentation don't cause us concern. What is more of a concern is the lack of scoping out Enderby's as an appropriate wharf use in the borough. But we've made that point very clearly in our local impact report.
Thank you.
Could you just clarify, I wonder whether it was a double negative or something that got crept in. You're concerned that, in a sense, the answer to the previous question, the way that the consequences of the Enderby Wharf development have not been, in a sense, regarded as significant, rather than the answer to the question that you've just been put.
My error. Sorry, I meant Brewery Wharf, not Enderby Wharf.
Right.
The fact that TfL are considering Brewery Wharf as an appropriate wharf for removal or delivery of goods to the site on the peninsula isn't one that the council supports. But as yet, we don't have an agreement for the use of river for any movement from the south side.
So at the moment, you're saying that all the barge traffic could be handled on the north side.
Yep.
And is that the Royal Borough's preference?
No, it's not.
No.
Absolutely isn't.
It's just a different jetty on the south side.
Yes, basically what we tried to do was enter into a scoping agreement with TfL for the use of river. They have scoped in Brewery Wharf as an appropriate wharf, which is less than 4 kilometres radius from the work site. But by road, it's closer to 10 kilometres and goes on local roads through the World Heritage Site and basically ends up at the wharf, which is currently servicing Thames Tideway Tunnel. So we're not happy of
Which wharf would the Royal Borough be seeking to?
We would want one of the peninsula wharfs to be used, Victoria Deep, one of the ones on the western side of the peninsula, which is much closer. Otherwise, we don't really see the point of taking heavy goods vehicles off the strategic or TLRN where they already are once they leave the peninsula to go through local roads and the World Heritage Site to get to Brewery Wharf.
Thank you very much. It's very helpful.
Thank you for that. Can we move on to agenda item 4.5, which is back to the applicant, following the same theme, and asking whether emissions from existing river barges, clippers and other forms of river transport and the river barges that are proposed for delivering materials and collecting waste considered in the cumulative impact section of updated Chapter 6. Mr. Humphreys.
Madam, again, Professor Laxon will deal with this.
Duncan Laxon, yes. Essentially, this was answered when I answered question 4.3 and indicated that the impacts from the tugs and barges would be insignificant. It's also the view that the impacts will be insignificant taken cumulatively with the other traffic on the River Thames that might arise from other developments.
Thank you, Professor Laxon. Nothing from my colleagues, so if we can move on then. 4.6, carbon dioxide is considered in terms of the updated regional assessment, but not in terms of air quality impacts upon local receptors, and we're asking if the applicant can explain to us why it's not included. Thank you.
Yes, madam. I think there's a very short answer to this, which I'll sort of explain. CO2 doesn't give rise to local impacts in that it doesn't, in a direct sense, affect health or the environment. The issue with CO2 is obviously relates to global warming, which is an altogether different issue, and national emissions are what's important, and that's why we have the regional assessment of CO2 emissions, and DMRB guidance only requires CO2 to be considered in terms of regional emissions. Professor Laxon can obviously elaborate on that if you want to, but it's not a local effect.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. Professor Laxon, if you'd like to comment. No? Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
I would just add that I have nothing further to add to that. Okay. It's been summarised appropriately.
Thank you. Moving on, 4.7 then. Further to Public Health England's representation, in lieu of a statement of common ground, please can the applicant provide an update regarding the potential for mitigation in areas around the Hoola development, including urban greening? Thank you. Ms. Humphreys.
Madam, yes. We did provide an update on discussions with Public Health England at deadline 2. That's REP2-039. And that included our response to various of the issues. As far as then the two points you raise, urban greening and then other mitigation, I'll just make some general points about urban greening, and then Mr. Pyatt can talk a little bit more about other mitigation and the Hula development and some further work we've done to look at the Hula development. But as a generality in relation to urban greening, we don't think that the sort of landscaping we're talking about here can be linked directly to a reduction in nitrogen oxide, as explained to Public Health England, and therefore that's not mitigation which is included in the ES. We think that, and I hope they will be able to confirm it, Public Health England has acknowledged this in their own submissions in response to first written question AQ19, when they say that there is limited evidence for urban greening improving air quality at pollution hotspots. That's REP1-074. TfL has discussed greening from a landscape point of view. Clearly, the design principles for the project at the Silvertown Tunnel do talk about, you know, greening and landscape proposals, but it's also important to bear in mind that the Hula development itself has landscape provisions immediately adjoining the development. So, as I say, we don't see that urban greening or some landscaping near the Hula development will have a direct or direct material effect on things such as nitrogen dioxide. It is worth saying, though, that as your question asks about sort of other mitigation, and I'll get Mr. Pyatt just to talk about that, but you've already heard, for example, about the commitment to Euro 6 buses, but I'll get Mr. Pyatt to explain that and also the further work that we have done looking at the effects on the Hula building.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. Mr. Pyatt.
Stephen Pyatt. Yeah, although the assessment shows that the scheme impacts are not significant, we have looked at how we could minimise the impacts of the scheme around the Hula development, which is one of the reasons why the Euro 6 bus commitment was included, to ensure that because of it, where the Hula development's located, it will be in a location where the new bus routes will affect the development. We've therefore, in the updated air quality assessment, along with the updated emissions, we've included for the provision of Euro 6 bus emissions within that assessment. But also, I think it's worth noting that the assumed opening year of the scheme is 2021, and it's acknowledged that the scheme is not likely to open until 2023. So we've also undertaken some additional work looking at pollutant contour plots around the Hula development to show the area which will exceed the 40 micrograms air quality objective in both 2021 and projected that forward to 2023. And it shows that even under the conservative assumptions we're making in terms of the modelling around that development, that by 2023 the modelling shows there wouldn't be any exceedances at any of the flats in the Hula development. So So the mitigation that we're proposing in terms of the buses would be appropriate for that area.
Could you clarify a bit more about the contribution that the bus element makes to the overall emissions associated with the tunnel? What proportion of the different emissions? And under what assumptions?
We don't have the exact proportions of the emissions, but we can certainly get that. The work that we've done previously, when we looked at what the impact of putting Euro 6 buses in as opposed to the basic fleet for the opening year, there would be about a 1 microgram reduction in NO2. And that was about the sort of reduction that we were modelling.
Where did that relate to?
That was it'd be the worst case point at the Hula development.
Right.
So we model the worst case receptor points. So the point at which the highest concentration will be located on the facade of the building.
Okay.
Yeah. It's receptor R51 in the environmental statement.
So is it? Would it be true to say that the buses will represent no more than about, rough terms, 1 to 2% of the traffic flow?
I think we need to come back and give you the exact percentages for that area.
Will you be able to provide a note then, giving this detailing?
Yes, sir. Certainly, it's just simply that Mr. Pyre doesn't happen to have the breakout of that particular figure.
I was just referring to the fact that we had quotes yesterday of, was it 44 buses and whatever the total flow was per hour for vehicles as a whole?
Yes, the obviously the assessment will, as I understand it, reflect the assess case, but we can explain this in the note.
The reason I'm asking is I cannot see how such a small proportion of the movements would generate significant effects.
I can't answer that. I'm not an air quality expert either, but we'll get Mr. Pyatt and the others to be able to explain that, and I don't know the answer.
We'll come back with that, but it will be the daily flow that will be included in the modelling. But we can provide that information, because that'll be more than obviously 37 trips. The actual trips will be a lot higher than that.
Then you would have more than 3,000 or 4,000 vehicle movements at the same time if it's over a day.
Yes, sir. I mean, I think we just need to go and interrogate the.
Yeah. Okay.
Figures.
Can we add that to our action points for homework for the applicant? Thank you.
Absolutely. We must have been very, very naughty to get quite so much homework. I seem to have done that throughout my life, actually. I was always on the naughty step.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. That's, anything else, Austin? To break my own rule slightly, we do have Public Health England in the audience and actually sitting at the table, and wondered if anybody from Public Health England would like to elaborate why they specifically requested this form of mitigation in their response. Thank you. Could you introduce yourself? And
Robert Caminieri, Public Health England. just to summarise, there is a significant and growing evidence on the health benefits of access to good quality green space. So it wasn't simply about air quality mitigation, it was about the wider health benefits, which is why we raised the point. And we'll look forward to reviewing the updated modelling and air quality assessment and can provide comments on that basis.
Thank you. Are you in discussion with the applicants about this request for green space around the Hula development at the moment?
The applicant's response noted that there were limitations around the ability to carry out greens, urban greening and landscaping in terms of the limits of the scheme, in terms of the spaces around the Hula building, but we're happy to take that forward with the applicant.
Thank you very much. If you could keep us posted at deadline 3 or later deadlines, that would be much appreciated. Thank you. Okay. In that case, can we move on to the next agenda item, which is 4.8, which again relates to a Public Health England point where they state that they would encourage any new road or traffic development to consider opportunities to secure improvements in local air quality. And we're asking if the applicant can briefly provide its response to that.
Madam, again, I think this is Mr. Pyatt who will deal with this.
Thank you.
Stephen Pyatt. Yeah, in terms of this scheme, in terms of the overall impacts, and that's what we look at in terms of determining whether the scheme has a significant impact, the scheme overwhelmingly results in improvements in air quality in areas with the poorest air quality, so the areas where there's exceedances of the air quality objectives. We've already sort of discussed the Euro 6 commitment, and there's also the monitoring strategy that will be in place post-operation of the scheme to ensure the impacts of the assessment, impacts of the scheme during operations, during operation is assessed. So we feel that the scheme's already securing improvements in air quality.
Thank you, Mr. Pyatt. You had two key matters there. One was Euro 6 buses, which we understand, but you then stated that your monitoring strategy would contribute towards mitigation, and monitoring and mitigation are different. One leads to the other, hopefully. And could you explain why you consider your monitoring strategy would help secure improvements in local air quality?
Yes, Stephen Pyatt. I think, what I meant to say was that the monitoring strategy would be in place to ensure that the scheme impacts are in line with what we've actually assessed, and the scheme is delivering improvements in air quality at the locations with the highest concentrations.
Thank you. Austin's got a question.
Yeah. Can you clarify for me two things? One is the status of the Euro 6 regulations as they would relate to buses.
Yeah, so any new buses that are Euro 6, any new buses that are bought or registered would need to be the Euro 6 standard. And I think that came in
about 2 years ago.
In
your glossary, I'm not sure it refers to buses, but maybe it does. I'm not sure the acronyms are in there.
Maybe, sir, that's something we can... Yeah. If just rectify, if that would be helpful.
Can I also ask you, had you considered, as opposed to Euro 6 buses, considering the possibility of using electrically powered buses?
I think that may be something for perhaps Mr. Rowe. I'm not even sure if he's in the room. Yes, he is. If it's not for him, he can shake his head, but is someone for... TfL rather than the air quality consultants.
Sir David Rowe from Transport for London. We have deliberately said Euro 6 or equivalent because we do want to maintain the flexibility that we can potentially adopt electric buses or other technology which would offer cleaner fuels if that's appropriate at the time when the scheme opens. We do have trials in London of pure electric buses together with other technologies such as hydrogen-powered buses. But these are trials at the moment, and what the applicant's very conscious of is ensuring that we have a workable solution at the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. And on that point, have you even considered the... this city had a wonderful network at one point of trolley buses. Had you thought at all about trolley bus?
We haven't thought about running trolley buses through the tunnel. No, I mean, buses provide for TfL a very flexible form of public transport in that obviously if there are particular issues on a route, then you can reroute, and it's that flexibility that really brought about a change in terms of the type of mass public transport that we've used within London. And we do believe that the bus is the appropriate solution in this location.
And one issue to relate, be interesting to hear more about, is the whole issue about the problem of diesel engines generally and the emissions problems that have emerged in the last couple of years. Do you think the Euro 6 measures will address that?
Duncan Laxon, this is something that in the air quality field we've been looking closely at for the last 10 years or so, because we've known that Euro standards haven't been delivering, and we've been sceptical for some time, and that's been borne out by recent studies that have shown Euro 3, 4 and 5 haven't delivered as expected. There is now evidence from the vehicles on the roads that Euro 6 standards are delivering real benefits, and this is particularly so for the heavy-duty vehicles, which will include buses. And this is in part because these are more expensive vehicles and they can afford the control technology, which has been one of the reasons why we're seeing improvements for those vehicles and not seeing improvements for cars, which haven't necessarily been able to afford that technology, which is perhaps why there's been that resistance to improving cars.
They use the word control technology. Is that a phrase you might want to comment upon in the light of diesel problems with cars? I assume you're talking about software.
No, it's not. It's not software. It's the hardware to selective catalytic reduction units that are fitted to the vehicles to reduce the emissions. The vehicle manufacturers have used different approaches, and they haven't all invested the money in putting in the most appropriate technology for cars, but they have for lorries and buses, and they are now delivering real measured on-the-road improvements.
It might be helpful in your note to add some, as an appendix, some of the information you've referred to there, and the issue of maybe explicitly reference to the possibility, at least, or potential of taking forward the findings from your trials of alternative fuel vehicles.
Thank you, Professor Laxon. As we have Public Health England in the audience, it would be a good opportunity just to pick up on their point here and to ask them if they could elaborate on the aspirations that they had in this statement when they're asking the applicant to consider opportunities to secure improvements in local air quality. Did you have any specific mitigation or improvements in mind when you wrote that comment? Thank you.
Thank you. Nicholas Brook, Public Health England. I'd like to thank TfL for their response there. And this is a generic some wording we've come up with around transport schemes to try and improve, see improvements in air quality where possible. And we do recognise that, after looking at the modelling data which TfL kindly provided, that there is more benefits at sensitive receptors as opposed to deteriorations in air quality. Also note that under the design manual for roads and bridges guidance, they've used that under the guidance it says there's no significant impact on air quality. But we don't have any specific mitigation we need to highlight at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Brook. Okay. I'll just look at my colleagues. No, nothing else on then from them. So can we move on then? So that was 4.8. So the last point in relation to Public Health England's response was in relation to their statement regarding the matter on which they disagree with the applicant, whether a 20-mile-per-hour speed zone would or wouldn't have potential benefits on local air quality. And it, I think the statement itself had a double negative in it, so if I can pass that to the applicant and ask whether there is a response to that request from Public Health England regarding whether a 20-mile-per-hour speed zone would assist local air quality. Thank you.
Yes, madam. I think there are probably two parts of this, and I'll get Mr. Rowe first to comment on the appropriateness more generally of a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit on this particular type of road in this location. But then I'll get Professor Laxon to just then comment on whether a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit, does deliver real benefits that would make a material difference in this case. But I'll just get Mr. Rowe to comment first.
Thank you. David Rowe from Transport for London. Firstly, I'd like there have been further discussions with Public Health England, and we note that they are now satisfied that a 20-mile-an-hour limit would not be a zone would not be appropriate on the primary traffic routes. And I think it's worth highlighting that Transport for London is responsible for London's main road network, which is known as the Transport for London Road Network, and typically when you look out on the street, it's the Red Route network across London. All other roads within London are the responsibility of the London boroughs, so in the vicinity of the scheme, that's the Royal Borough of Greenwich and London Borough of Newham and London Borough of Tower Hamlets. In certain circumstances, we do think 20-mile-an-hour zones are appropriate, and we work with the London boroughs to implement those. But typically, on main road network, those are locations such as high streets, where you have slow-moving traffic throughout the day, and you have significant interaction between different types of users, like pedestrians, cyclists, and traffic. The conditions here are somewhat different. The scheme is being implemented to create free flow conditions. These are roads which are predominantly used by vehicleised traffic, and in these circumstances we think a 30 mile an hour limit is appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Professor Laxon, I believe. Thank you.
Duncan Laxon, just to add a few additional comments here, as Mr. Rowe has indicated, the 20-mile-an-hour limits are being introduced for reasons other than air quality, principally, but it's still appropriate to consider what the implications might be for air quality. In the early days of implementing 20-mile-an-hour limits, we were turned to the speed emission curves that we use for our modelling work, which would suggest that at slower speeds there are more emissions, which led us to initially think that 20-mile-an-hour zones were bad news for air quality. But there have been some studies since then that have looked at what's happening on the more congested urban roads, road networks, and there is now evidence that implementing a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit will actually reduce emissions on these roads because it helps smooth the traffic flow, and in particular it avoids acceleration because the principal stage at which emissions of nitrogen dioxide are high is when the vehicle is accelerating. So the message now is that 20-mile-an-hour zones are probably a good thing for air quality, but there's not strong evidence to support that.
And
Mr. Humphreys,
again, if I can just come back to Mr. Rowe, as far as the strategic network is concerned, what are the possible, just in sort of traffic routing terms, what are the potential implications of imposing very low speed limits on strategic routes?
So just to come back to one of my earlier points, we do look at 20-mile-an-hour zones, and TfL is trialling 20-mile-an-hour zones on parts of the strategic road network, but typically they are high street-type locations. So throughout the day, these are locations with slow-moving traffic. There are other issues that we're looking to address, such as safety and vulnerability of road users. And for the reasons my colleague Duncan Laxon outlined, these are typically stop-start type traffic conditions where 20 mile an hour can help improve and address those issues. But there are also environments where there is a certain amount of self-regulation in terms of the speed because of that congested nature of the highway network. The type of conditions that we are forecasting here at the tunnel are very different from that. We are looking at free flow conditions. These are a bus lane and a general traffic lane in each direction. There is less interaction with pedestrians and cyclists on these roads. And for those reasons, we do not believe that a 20-mile-an-hour limit is appropriate. We did initially look at higher speeds than 30 miles an hour, but we wanted to try and ensure that we kept a appropriate speed in the approaches and the tunnel itself, partly to reflect the fact that we do expect this area to be built up over time, but obviously these roads will continue to largely be dominated in terms of motorised traffic.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Austin.
Following up on that last observation, have you done assessments about the capacity of the road or the scheme at different speed limits? And what that would mean in terms of the overall strategy for charging and inclusion of discounts and such like.
So I think we would need to have the modellers here. Certainly I am not aware from reading the documents that those things have been looked at. I think someone's just going to see if we can drag one of the modellers kicking and screaming, you know, back into this room. But if they have, it's not something I can say that I recall reading. We'll see.
It might be useful as an adjunct to this to find out about that, in the sense that I assume with free flow conditions, at higher speeds you're going to get a higher throughput, and thus you could cope with additional flow of traffic effectively.
Yes,
at great speed. At free
Mr.
flow.
Mr. King is arriving, so you can see from the smile on his face that he's very pleased to be here. Because he was, I think, in the corridor, he may not have heard all of the question, but the point that Mr. Smith was putting is whether we've done any sensitivity testing looking at lower speeds and the effect that that might have on, in effect, flow capacity through the tunnel, and whether that has any potential implications or interaction with the overall charging regime. And I said I didn't recall ever seeing something of that sort, but I may just not have seen it.
Actually, lower or higher speeds?
Lower. Yeah. So I apologise. I'm trying to summarise something. Lower or higher car speeds.
Hello, Tom King, Transport for London. So on the first part, have we modelled different speeds? The short answer is no, we haven't, and that is largely in view of the reasons that David was giving in relation to the suitability of those roads for those kind of speeds. Obviously, there are safety considerations in one direction, and there are journey time considerations in the other direction, and we felt that the speed limit adopted was the appropriate one. As to the question around the interrelationship with that choice and the charging regime, I have to confess I'm not immediately clear on what the relationship might be there that you're alluding to, but if you could elaborate, I'll try and respond.
Simplistically, the higher the speed, the greater the throughput of traffic. So therefore, that would give you an opportunity to cope with greater flows of traffic. Therefore, that might have some implications for charging.
Okay. Tom King, Transport for London. I probably should go back and look at the data that we've got on this, but my answer, kind of off the cuff, as it were, would be that I wouldn't expect the overall throughput over the course of the extended period of time, say a day, to be materially affected by that kind of change to any great extent. As I say, I probably should check my data and think that through.
I'm thinking more of peak hour conditions.
If you wouldn't mind, I think I ought to take the time to think that through and come back with something a bit more worked out.
One technical point. From what you're saying, is the tunnel being designed with a specification of 30 miles per hour being the speed of traffic within the tunnel?
So, yes, the tunnel is being designed with a 30-mile-an-hour speed limit. Now, we have to build in there an allowance in terms of people who may exceed the speed limit, ensuring that we create a safe environment for people above that. But that is the design speed that we're working to. We've also used Department of Transport advice in relation to matters such as lane widths and other considerations in terms of how we design the road to ensure that it's suitable.
Thank you, Mr. King. Thank you, Austin. Peter?
Could I just, in a sense, get confirmation? Is the Blackwall Tunnel, despite its less good dimensions, also intended design with the expectation of 30 miles an hour? I didn't see any lower speed when we went through it, but...
Tom King, Transport London. I mean, I don't think it was probably designed with that speed in mind, given its age, but...
It's accepted to be operated at 30 miles an hour. Yeah.
Thank you. Again, as this point was derived from Public Health England, it would be fair to ask Public Health England to comment on this matter and to see whether they accept the applicant's explanations there or whether they still wish to pursue this difference of opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Nicholas Brook, Public Health England. I just want to clarify, the first thing I'd like to say is that within our response, we weren't asking for, you know, definitely a 20-mile-per-hour zone to be implemented, because as highlighted by TfL, there are obviously, you know, some logistical difficulties with that, especially on TLRN routes. However, our request was simply around the model in which has already just been brought up, and whether, you know, a 20-mile-per-hour zone has been modelled, because obviously if a 20-mile-per-hour zone was modelled, and the evidence isn't great either way for air quality, but we thought it would be useful for it to be modelled so, you know, you could see any potential benefits on air quality given the change in speed limit on the roads in and around the Silvertown Tunnel.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. I think your colleague wishes to comment.
Additional to that, Robbie Caminieri, it was really to provide an evidence base to inform the traffic impact mitigation strategy, which refers to varying speed limits in relation to traffic demand. Therefore, that modelling might have been helpful in informing that traffic impact mitigation strategy as well.
Thank you. Are you proposing to submit an update to us at deadline 3?
We'd be happy to take it forward in discussion with TfL, yes.
That would be helpful, thank you, in that case. I think that's probably the end of those three points that relate to Public Health England at the moment, so thank you for that. If we could move on to agenda item 410, which is in relation to the updated Chapter 6 of the Environmental Statement. On the basis that we now have a newer updated air quality and health assessment submitted at deadline 2, the question to the applicant is whether the Chapter 6 is going to be updated again to reflect the details in the updated air quality and health assessment, or whether updates are necessary in the light of the recent High Court judgment, and also to ask the applicant which of the air quality documents will be certified. So, Mr. Humphreys. Thank you.
Madam, thank you. I think in relation to, I think, what was in effect the middle of the points made there, which was, does Client Earth 2 change the latest assessment? I think Mr. Pyatt's probably dealt with that. I hope clearly under one of the previous subheadings that Client Earth doesn't change the updated assessment because we have already added in those adjustments to the emission factor toolkit. In relation to the point about whether or not we need to update Chapter 6 and or how this would be dealt with in terms of certification of documents. Madam, I think what we had in mind that we could do, bearing in mind that the update was to reflect some sort of additional points of additional sensitivities, including the three factors that were set out in that update document. One way of dealing with this in terms of certification would be to make sure that in the definition of the environmental statement in, I think, Schedule 14, which lists all the documents to be certified, and against the environmental statement it identifies various documents and document numbers, we could simply add the updated air quality and health assessment as one of the documents that by definition is included in the overall definition of the environmental statement, and therefore it could be certified in that way. Short point, we're not opposed to it being certified as being, as reflecting, you know, taking into account the Euro 6 commitment, taking into account the various other things, including the overheight vehicles. But we have no problem with that being identified as what we now believe to be the effects. Simply a question of how that is certified and whether or not we need to replace Chapter 6 or whether this is an alternative way of doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. Peter, do you wish to comment on that? Peter?
No, I think we can look at that again tomorrow.
So, thank you.
Thank you for that. In that case, can we move on to 411, which has got two parts. So, I'm
happy to come in after 11, but I may want to refer to what's been referred to in 10, if that's all right. Thank you.
If that's okay, yes, if we can go through 11, 12 and then at 13. Interested parties can refer to anything in this section. Thank you. 411 in that case relates to the issues raised by host boroughs in relation to the inadequate nature of the air quality assessment and proposed monitoring for air quality. So the first point is to the applicant and to the host authorities, and would be grateful for an update whether there's yet agreement in respect of the assessed case in respect of air quality, which we touched on yesterday, but as we're now doing environmental issues, it would be good to recap on what we discussed yesterday and to provide an update for those in the audience who weren't here yesterday. Mr. Humphreys, thank you.
Madam, yes. I think the short point, we've set out our air quality assessment and we've obviously explained the traffic modelling on which that is based. Yesterday we also elaborated on the expansion factors, and Mr. Pyatt, you know, has explained how the air quality modelling then takes that data and converts it into, in effect, a dispersion model that allows you to look at the air quality effects for different pollutants at different receptor locations. As far as we are concerned, as you will understand, that is perfectly appropriate. We've followed the prescribed guidance in relation to those things, and we've explained what we've done. The authorities have raised a number of, as I said yesterday, in effect, generalized concerns. They've said, look, we're not satisfied with this, and we think this might be wrong. They haven't on the whole, but where they have, we've dealt with it. They haven't on the whole said, no, this figure is wrong and this other figure is correct and you should use this. So there's no direct case that we are meeting on those points, but they simply say, look, we're, you know, not satisfied with this and we have concerns about that. So, you know, for our part, we, I hope it's obvious, don't accept that the air quality assessment is in some way inadequate. It follows, as I say, appropriate guidance procedures and protocols that are prescribed for these things, and the models are all ones that are well known and tried and tested.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. So if I could pass it to the host authorities, should we start with Greenwich, if you have a comment on an update on discussions. Thank you.
Thank you. Kim Smith, Greenwich. We've not yet had further meetings with the environmental health team from TfL on this. I believe some are being scheduled in the near future to try and move the statement of common ground forward. What I would say is, just to repeat what we've said throughout, we do have an issue with the fact that the traffic model which underlies all of these assumptions, we still have questions about, and about the outputs of that traffic model. In respect to proposals for monitoring, the mitigation strategies, we believe, need to be identified ahead of the scheme opening. At the moment, all the triggers are based around around traffic issues. We believe we need some definite triggers around air quality issues as well to be included in the documents, and are happy to take those discussions forward with TfL.
Thank you. Could I pass to Newham?
Robin Whitehouse, Newham. We heard quite a lot yesterday regarding the issues relating to the traffic inputs that would go into the air quality and noise models. There was some considerable time spent in trying to get some idea of the quality of that data and the importance of various changes, the variations that could occur that wouldn't be readily known about at this point. It is these issues that mean that we in Newham are not satisfied with the air quality and noise assessment because of these variations and because of, and it goes on to your next point, so I won't iterate that now, but it goes on to the point of what control measures are in place if it doesn't happen to turn out like has been expected. The models are very sensitive, and perhaps the now is not necessarily the best time, but the Hula development has been remodelled, as was discussed, and with the additional 400 overhyped vehicles. Now, this is 400 vehicles in a flow of 22,000 or so vehicles a day. That 400 vehicles actually caused a worsening of air quality, despite the modelling of the Euro 6 in. And my point, and I can come back to that later, but my point is that quite small changes can give rise to significant effects, significant in the narrower sense of in actual fact that gave rise to an additional 0.8 microgram change in nitrogen dioxide. It was interesting to note that it's actually got worse on that assessment, not better. So it's the narrowness and these small effects that means that we've always suggested that we need to do some sensitivity modelling so we understand what could be. We do not believe this to be the reasonable worst case. That's I suppose is the easiest way to make that statement. And more work is required to ensure both in terms of the modelling and in terms of how we mitigate and control such movements before we would be satisfied.
Thank you. Should we go on to Tower Hamlets and then the panel has got a few questions, I think, but we'll ask Tower Hamlets to give us an update, if that's okay. Thank you.
Bobbin at Tower Hamlets, I deal with the first bullet point and my colleague Stephanie Hughes will deal with the second follow-up point. The situation on the assessment is really the same as the other two boroughs in terms of still concerns about it. We had some concerns raised in the written representations about things like monitoring locations and so on, which we've not been taken forward yet in discussions with the applicant, and it's the same point as Greenwich really. We hope they can be at some point. I think the other thing just to add is that we talked about the traffic impact mitigation strategy yesterday, which I think, as Robin said, focused on traffic effects, but clearly air quality is an impact that should be monitored as well. And some of those increases that were listed as being where the where the assessment would be reviewed and mitigation reviewed seem very high in terms of air quality impact, but my colleague can deal with that later on.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. I'll ask my colleagues if they've got anything on those.
I suppose the only comment I've got at the moment is back to the Royal Borough, where you said you had reservations about some of the traffic modelling. I think Mr. Humphreys, in introducing the point, said, you know, in a sense, nothing specific was being thrown at TfL rather than just lack of confidence in some of it. So in a sense, is the point as expressed by on behalf of Newham that there really isn't enough confidence in the sensitivities that might exist, that it might be worse, it might actually be better, but you can't really be sure, and therefore is it an issue that something like that M4 requirement might be able to satisfy you, that if it isn't as anticipated, there is a mechanism for addressing it, though I was going to go on to ask a more general question. The comment was mitigation needs to be identified in advance. Are the boroughs actually satisfied that there are mitigation solutions available? It's all very well to say that it needs to be identified in advance. Have you ideas as to what more mitigation could be undertaken to solve the problems?
Kim Smith, Greenwich. I suppose there are two aspects to that. One is as Robin said, we'd welcome more sensitivity tests around the air quality issues. We think that would be helpful. Once the genie is out of the lamp, it's very difficult to put it back in again. So how we mitigate if the exceedances are beyond the assessed case once it's happened is terribly difficult. What I believe we have to do is have the level of certainty and surety around the future flows that will allow us to reach the levels of the assessed case. And I think that's something that with TfL we still have to work on. Our concerns around that were made very clear yesterday, concerns around the value of time and how that affects the models. It's something that is a work in progress with TfL. I certainly think we need some sort of mitigation included in the DCO around it. Whether the M4 example is the correct one, it certainly has some interesting aspects to it, and I think that's something we need to take forward in discussion with colleagues at TfL.
thank you. In that case, can we move on to the second bullet point, because that's very timely. Would you like to say anything further about that requirement at the moment, or would you like to leave that until tomorrow's DCO discussion?
I think we prefer to defer till tomorrow, if that's okay.
That's fine, thank you. Does Newham have any comments on the requirement in the M4 DCO and whether something along those lines may assist in terms of if the proposed mitigation measures did not work as expected?
Robin Whitehouse, London Borough Review. Council does see value in such a model. Importantly, the model can't react or can't be in place instead of a robust assessment in the first place, because it's that robust assessment which would allow the design of the scheme to allow for additional mitigation if it becomes required because of unforeseen changes. And so certainly in terms of physical changes, you know, barriers or greening has been discussed before, clearly that would have to be designed into the scheme. You can't, once the scheme is built, you wouldn't have the ability to do very much in that. But there's also traffic management issues. There was reference to the possible use of a lower speed limit, which could benefit the scheme through effectively operating as traffic calming. So that's there. There could be a commitment to the tunnel and the environs being put into the ultra low emission zone that's being discussed elsewhere at the moment. There's a possibility that this scheme would be out with that. So that would be something, because that would obviously increase the number of low emission vehicles going through the process. So there are things that can be done, and such a DCO commitment would be, I would think, could be beneficial.
Thank you, Mr. Whitehouse. Can we turn to Tower Hamlets, Mr. Bennett, or your colleague, sorry.
Hi, Stephanie Hughes, Tower Hamlet. I just want to say I agree with Robin from Newham that it would be useful to have something similar to this, as then it would include an air quality trigger as well as just the traffic triggers for mitigation. For us at Tower Hamlets, though, what would need addressing first was our previous issue about the lack of monitoring, as the mitigation triggers are only obviously used if there's monitoring data to start with, so we suggested a couple of extra monitoring points that have not been included.
Thank you for that update. Does the panel have anything further? No. Okay. I will ask Mr. Humphreys for our responses, although I think we have the applicant's views on something similar to this requirement previously in previous representations. Thank you.
Yes, I'll wrap up two or three things here, because there are a number of points made. I mean, I think the first point, and a lot of the initial comments were along the lines of lack of confidence and need for sensitivity testing. It is important to recognise, of course, that there was very extensive sensitivity testing, which looked at, you know, things such as higher and lower growth or different values of time and so on. But the way in which, because this is a scheme where there is a charge, the applicant didn't simply say, right, we'll put in a different value of time and we'll just allow the flows to be higher or lower, or we'll assume more growth or less growth and we'll allow the flows to be higher or lower. Obviously, the response in the context of the user charging policy and procedure would be, if those sensitivities occurred, we would respond to them by changing the charge. And so in all cases, all the sensitivities, we simply responded by the use of the charge to bring the flows back to the same. So all sensitivity and all uncertainty ultimately would be controlled, amongst other things, by flexibility in the charge. Now, once you get the particular flow, which is one based on the assess case flow or something very similar. The air quality modelling uses the prescribed procedures, and Mr. Pyatt can confirm this, but the air quality modellers would say, look, they have a very high degree of confidence that is an appropriate tool. Those are, frankly, exactly the same tools that are used everywhere, and that we are required to use in this sort of case. So, many of those concerns about uncertainty ultimately are dealt with in that way, and this is important, and it's important coming into the requirement 26 point. Of course, there are very few other schemes in the UK that actually can deal with uncertainty in that way. Certainly the M4 couldn't, because that's not a tolled road, and therefore if there was uncertainty, it would have led to a higher or lower, or in other ways different, flow. Now, that brings us to requirement 26. Clearly, in the context of the M4, where there wasn't a charge, it was necessary to consider again uncertainty, and in that case the applicant Highways England had not proposed extensive monitoring as part of the original application. That became an issue, and ultimately it was recommended and the Secretary of State imposed the particular requirement we have. Now, what does that requirement do if we look at it? Firstly, it says that where the mean concentrations are above the national air quality objective and there is predicted to be in the environmental assessment an increase of more than 0.4 micrograms per meter cubed, which comes from the AIN, that there should be monitoring. Secondly, it tells us that the monitoring then has to be fed into an independent review. It then tells us that if above the air quality objective there are material worsenings of the air quality, the undertaker has to, Highways England, has to consult the authorities, submit a scheme of mitigation and implement the scheme. And the scheme of mitigation is submitted to the Secretary of State. Now, I'm not aware that that mitigation and what it would comprise and whether it would be effective was known to the M4 inquiry. It was simply said that a scheme of mitigation. Certainly there was no charge. Now, for our part, I mean, I think my first position would be that we actually think that the far more extensive monitoring program that we have, which doesn't just monitor in locations above the 40 microgram per meter cubed where there is an increase of 0.4 caused by the scheme locations, in our monitoring is far more extensive. It's in a lot of other areas. Secondly, as far as mitigation is concerned, unlike the requirement 26 scheme, where simply a scheme has to be submitted to the Secretary of State, we've actually identified in TIMS a number of measures, and as I've made very clear, we also regard the use of the charge as a way of mitigating these effects. So unlike in the M4 and requirement 26 where all of that was unknown, we actually have a high degree of certainty on those things. Now, in answer to the point, well, hang on, how do we know you're going to use the charge in that way? That's why we have the user charging policy and procedures document, which locks in the particular objectives that we have to meet, which include, obviously, objectives related to the environment. Now, make it clear that we haven't completely closed our minds to trying to take on board other things, whether as part of the charging policy or otherwise, that might be seen to strengthen the position. But our opening position is we go way beyond requirement 26, not only in terms of extent, but also in terms of the particularity of what we are proposing by way of mitigation.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. If I could put in 2 points there. First one from our discussion yesterday when the panel had raised some issues about whether the TIMS document in its current format is fit for purpose, because the mitigation triggers do not, as far as we could see, relate to the assess case for the air quality and the noise parts of the environmental statement. But also, we understand where you're coming from, Mr. Humphreys, but at the end of the day, whatever the outcome of our report, we have to put forward a recommended DCO so that if the Secretary of State was minded to make the order, then the Secretary of State would have regard to our comments and our suggestions and our changes. And we have heard both the sides from the local authorities and your side, and we have to put them in the balance, and we also have to take other factors into account. And so whatever your view about something akin to requirement 26 of the M4, it is actually on the DCO, whereas your suggestions are further down the hierarchy in terms of document control and documents that could be changed, and the hierarchy of hurdles that we heard from some of the local authorities yesterday in terms of the hurdles that would have to be jumped through before those triggers were met, whereas a requirement on the DCO is there, it's law, and that's why we feel that this may be a solution, and that's why we are asking whether the local authorities consider it could help if your mitigation, your TIMS report, your STIG panel that meets once a year or whatever, isn't actually going to be sufficient in terms of triggering mitigation at the right time in the right place.
Madam, there are two or three slightly different points there. I mean, the point about it being sort of further down the list because it's in the one of the documents, it's important to understand the status of certified documents and why legally documents are certified. What does that mean? And you can get that if you go back to the 1946 Statutory Instruments Act, which says that a statutory instrument, when it's made, is sent to, what was at the time, if you read the original document, the King's printer, now the Queen's printer. The following year, in 1947, the Statutory Instruments Regulations, I can't remember which regulation it is, I think it might be Regulation 6, says that where, in effect, the person making the order, which would be the Secretary of State, considers that there are either schedules or other documents, my interpolation, which would be bulky, instead of having to send them all to be printed by the King's printer, the Queen's printer, you can just certify them. In other words, rather than having to print them as part of the statutory instrument, which for an environmental statement would obviously be pretty unnecessary, you just certify them. Therefore, it's I understand what you mean when you say, well, it's sort of further down the list, but actually the certification of the documents actually is quite an important legal step. Now, there is some logic in having certain things kept in the certified documents rather than importing everything into the schedules to the DCO. And that's not just because Queen's printer doesn't have to print so much. There's actually some logic in keeping like things together so that, you know, for example, with the code of construction practice, you know, that can be given to a contractor and said, right, you have to comply with this. It is all in the same place. As I've said in relation to Requirement 26, of course, at the end of the day, the Secretary of State can just impose it if the Secretary of State thinks that appropriate. What I've tried to say, though, is that we think we have actually captured, really, and probably gone beyond the points in there. If there is some wording in the user charger policy or some other document that's important, then of course we're willing to look at that. But the reason of obviously why TIMS doesn't include environmental triggers is it's a traffic impact mitigation strategy. It's related to the traffic flow measures. When you look at the user charging policy and the schedule related to that, that's the one that has the, I can't remember what it's called now, but the, you know, the large, I think it's coloured schedule about all the measures that would be taken into account when setting the user charge. And that doesn't set triggers in quite the way that TIMS does in its appendix. But, you know, we would see, insofar as it's appropriate to have discussions over how that might operate, that would be the space that one would be looking at as to how those things were done. Sorry, madam, that's probably a long answer to what was a short question, but I thought it was worth sort of trying to explain how we see these things fitting together.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. My colleague Peter Rowbottom would like to add a point, I think.
Yeah, I think you've explained very much how, under what you're putting forward, through you know, TIMS, yes, and the user charging, the traffic flows are being intended to be monitored and controlled. But we were talking yesterday about the uncertainties that exist in all the modelling and in the relationship between the modelling of traffic and the outturns in relation to air quality or noise, but air quality we're talking about here. So the problem is that even if you get the modelled traffic flow through these other procedures, you may not get the intended air quality resulting. You know, the current expertise and science says, yes, that's what you would get, but we've had these problems with all the diesel emissions and all sorts of, yes, other things that have been implying that you aren't necessarily going to get the outturn in air quality that you like. So I think what, in terms of, in sense, referring to the M4 condition, we're wanting to have people to address their minds to, is that there is perhaps, and I think the boroughs are saying this, a need to directly monitor the air quality and so be prepared to take action if the relationship between the air quality and the traffic flows are not what was anticipated.
Yes, sir.
So I think, therefore, not the wording necessarily of the M4 condition, no, but something but that will directly purpose. Monitor air quality.
Yes, sir. I mean, completely understood. I mean, I think clearly we regard what we've done as trying to meet that objective. It's obvious to me that you would like us to see if we can do more in relation to that. Maybe requirement 26, not the wording and the precise way it's set out, but some of the concepts there, it clearly has focused on areas where there is both an excess of 0.4 microgram per meter cube predicted in the environmental statement and annual mean concentrations above the national air quality objective. Those are the areas that are to be monitored, and therefore that seems to be the focus. It may be that we can look to see whether we can sort of build something around those sorts of concepts, take things from Requirement 26 and build it into the structures that we have got. I think before committing to anything in particular, I think we would need to sort of sit down carefully, I'm sure you would understand, and just think about that and how that would work and what would happen if there was an uncertainty and there was an exceedance of those things, certainly in requirement 26. It doesn't say you shut the M4, but you clearly propose how you're going to mitigate. And you know, so let us take that away and see if we can explore that sort of idea.
Austin has a point on this.
Yes. Thank you very much indeed. I think that I was going to come in, and the points that Peter has alluded to are germane to this. Mr. Humphreys, you used the word a few moments ago. There was a high degree of certainty that would emerge from the extensive work that is being undertaken to look at a range of scenarios, be of a demographic nature or economic nature. And I wholeheartedly note that. I think the point that we're making, and was reflected in the action from yesterday, but also underpins the philosophy or thinking behind the M4 considerations, is the fact that there are several sources of uncertainty, a more emotive word is error, but let's call it uncertainty, that emerge at each stage in a process of this sort. I mean, there is the uncertainty surrounding, undoubtedly, the way in which an economy develops or in the way in which the population changes, which reflects those scenarios that you've referred to. And I totally acknowledge that there's been extensive work done on that, of that sort. But there's also several other sources. There's a specification error in the models themselves. And those models represent a linked set of models so that you can have an error building on an error propagated through the system of models. So that's where there's uncertainty going through the system. And then when you translate the traffic projections into inputs to another tool for air quality, then there are inevitably even more uncertainties. I think it's that range of uncertainties, and also, of course, there's measurement error as well in all of these things, that gives rise to the fact that there is a significant degree of uncertainty, and that's just to reflect the reality of dealing with abstractions of the real world. So I think that's why the paper or note or whatever you want to call it that we've asked for is critical to both an understanding of that level of uncertainty and also giving a degree of comfort to interested parties who might be trying to understand where that uncertainty stems from.
So thank you for sort of elaborating that, and I know I'm not allowed to ask you questions, but that never normally stops me. I mean, you've clearly drawn to our attention requirement 26, which was what the Secretary of State imposed in relation to the M4 to deal with, reading the report and the decision letter, uncertainty. I've said we will go away and sort of I doubt that we would think it appropriate to replicate quite this, because it would just simply duplicate many of the things we're doing. But look, taking the sort of thrust of that is something that creates some form of, I'll call it a trigger, but it may not be equivalent to other triggers, something equivalent to what the Secretary of State has imposed here, which means that if uncertainty in air quality did emerge, and if there was exceedance above a certain level, above the national air quality objective values, that might be something that the panel would welcome. I'm not suggesting that that would necessarily satisfy you, but it would be worth us exploring that and doing this work to see if that helped.
I think really the important point is to recognise that there is uncertainty, and that uncertainty can lead to unanticipated outcomes, and therefore those unanticipated outcomes need to be addressed, and in this case we're talking about air quality. So I think it's the humility born of years of dealing with models, that there's no such thing as certainty. in the words that you use. So therefore, no matter how extensive your scenario testing is, there'll always be that element. So it's actually to have a mechanism or a series of measures to be able to deal with those outcomes when they do arise or if they arise.
So that's very helpful indeed. We can take that away. I should add that I have humility from years of being wrong about things. So there we are. I think that might be an appropriate moment now. That gives us an opportunity to take those points away.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. Thank you, Austin and Peter. I'm looking at the time, but the position where we are in the agenda, I think the panel considers it would be helpful if we could finish this substantive agenda item on air quality before we break for lunch. So if you could bear with us, and we will let you have an hour for lunch, but if we could proceed with 4:12 and then throw it open to all other interested parties before lunch, that would be very helpful. So the next question from us is for the neighbouring authorities in relation to concerns that they've raised. And we're asking for updates as to whether there's agreement yet with the applicant on whether the proposed development would affect their local air quality management work, where they're working towards improving air quality against the EU limit values, and whether there's any way forward seen or envisaged or aspired to in terms of assessing how much more difficult it would be for the local authorities neighbouring the proposed development if the order was made to achieve the limit values that they would need to achieve if the development went ahead. So I've suggested there Lewisham, Southwark and Hackney. I don't mind who starts. Yes, please could you announce yourself?
Of course, thank you very much, Madam. My name is Stephanie Hall on behalf of the London Borough of Southwark. I've got next to me Dr. Beckett, who I'll pass to you in a little bit, and he'll address you on the specifics. But mindful of everyone's stomachs and time, I'll keep it brief. The answer's no. There is no agreement at the moment. In short, and I'll keep it sort of short and high level, and I'll pass anything complicated to Dr. Beckett. We say that we're not able to agree this at the moment for the same sort of rationale for why we raise broader points about air quality, which is essentially we don't have any assessment, modelling or monitoring undertaken by TfL or proposed to be undertaken by TfL in the London Borough of Southwark's area. We say that there ought to be because there's an impact which falls to be assessed prior to consent and monitored or mitigated as appropriate after any grant of consent or implementation of that consent, because in our view there is likely to be a significant or at least some effect. And at the least at the moment, even on TfL's case, it reaches the trigger points for further assessment, particularly in relation to Towerbridge and Rotherhithe Tunnel. And, of course, the panel will be aware that our concern about the increase of traffic raised yesterday goes hand in hand with a concern about a consequent worsening in air quality. And I'll just address you very briefly, if I may, on the two points where we say, you know, absent our case and any other sort of more detailed criticisms of the way TfL have gone about their assessment at the moment, we say, well, it falls to be assessed at Towerbridge and Rotherhithe in particular. Firstly, at Towerbridge, TfL have accepted that there's a traffic impact worthy of monitoring at that location. And so we say, well, you know, that goes hand in hand with an air quality impact which falls to be assessed. And secondly, in relation to Rotherhithe, the adjacent river crossings report, which is 8.41, I've got in mind particularly figure 3.1, that shows an increase in vehicles using the crossing, which is, well, depending on which paragraph of that report you read, either a little bit under or a little bit over the DMRB trigger for an assessment. And Dr. Beckett will address you on whether DMRB figures are the right figures to be using. But just on the applicant's case, DMRB trigger would be 1,000. That adjacent river crossings report, depending on the paragraph you read, either says we're at 900 or it says we're at 1,100. So looking at figure 3.1, you're at a figure, an increase over the DMRB threshold for triggering an air quality assessment. So just on those two points, even if I accept everything that the applicant says, that should, in my submission, trigger some monitoring and assessment within the London Borough of Southwark. But at the moment, we don't have any commitment to do anything at all. So if I could just pass then to Dr. Beckett to address you on the specifics.
Paul Beckett, I'm representing Southwark and also Lewisham today. I'll start by saying that the reasons that the applicant has given for not assessing impacts on the neighbouring boroughs is that they've used this quite high threshold DMRB screening criterion. And we'd argue that, or we have argued that we don't believe that that's appropriate. And I'll come on to some evidence that supports that. Particularly because of the uncertainty that has been revealed by the host boroughs. And today, Newham has also said that the update to the air quality assessment has shown that a relatively small increase in traffic has had a seemingly disproportionate impact on the Hoola development. So in spite of all this uncertainty that we've already discussed with traffic data and the air pollution model anyway, the recent work by the applicant has shown that actually we can get quite large effects on air quality that don't show that the screening criteria used was appropriate. Similarly, as my colleagues just said, the increase in traffic that's been shown in the river crossing document, that's REP2-049, suggests that there is an increase in traffic into Rotherhithe that is greater than the DMRB screening criterion. So for that reason, we think that there is likely to be significant effects in Southwark and also Lewisham, particularly on a number of air pollution hotspots, such as Rotherhithe, as coming out of the tunnel, but also along Lower Road and Evelyn Street, the Evelyn Street corridor, which is a focus area that TfL is actually working with the borough on improving air quality and understanding how to manage it there. Also, along that corridor, along the Lower Road and Evelyn Street, there are schools, and schools and children are particularly sensitive to air quality. Recent monitoring that's only just become available from the last 5 months by Southwark, close to that school and a similar distance from the road, shows that it's currently the average concentration there is currently exceeding the air quality standard by 20%. And in light of recent reports that all the host boroughs have mentioned and the neighbouring boroughs in their local impact reports, there is significant concern in London about the impact of air pollution and traffic on school children. So basically what we want or what we need in order to answer any of these questions, in order to agree with or disagree with the applicant, we need a robust assessment of the scheme's impacts on the neighbouring boroughs. And married to that, we then need assurance that the necessary mitigation measures will actually deliver improvements. And we currently have no faith in that. I think that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Dr. Beckett. Do we have anybody from a London Borough of Hackney here? The moment.
Not today. They'd like you to refer to their written representation and their local impact report.
Thank you. We'll do that, of course.
Thank you.
Anything from the panel on those comments? No. Shall we?
I suppose you've obviously heard what the host borough said and our subsequent dialogue with the applicant. Subject, obviously, to assessment of what the situation is at the moment, which, you know, there has been, you know, suggesting is not enough information. But subject to that, would the kind of direct air quality monitoring and then triggering mitigation be something which, you know, if it was extended outside the host boroughs, be something that might satisfy your concerns?
It would be desirable, but we don't know that monitoring on its own is actually going to deliver improvements in air quality.
No, well, I can see the issue about whether mitigation is actually possible, but you know, the monitoring is at least a trigger to consider how mitigation, you know, when mitigation would then be required.
Yes, it is something we would like, yes.
Thank you for that.
Sorry, I've just had my shoulder tapped from my client. So it's Stephanie Hall from London Borough of Southwark. We need to agree the baseline, of course, before monitoring would be. We could agree that. And at the moment, because we have this question over the figures used for vehicles going through the Rotherhithe, I referred to the 1,100 trips generated that feature in the additional river crossings report. That figure variously appears as either 900 or 1,100. I'm sure the applicant will provide some clarification on that. But just that is just one item of the baseline that we don't agree at the moment because there's some uncertainty in that. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Are there any other local authorities represented here who would like to contribute at this point? I can't see anybody in that case. I'm prepared to go back to the applicant for an update. Obviously, we don't want a rebuttal, but just to confirm whether there is a possibility of this work being carried out within the timescale of the examination.
Madam, I think Mr. Pyatt will have to answer. I mean, I think we would just like to very briefly deal with the sort of general proposition, because the question was about the the overall effect on LAQM's LAQM work towards improving air quality limits. So I think we'd just like to deal with that, but then we can perhaps go on to the point as it developed.
Thank you, Mr. Pyatt, then.
Stephen Pyatt. Yeah, in terms of the impact on air quality management areas, we've provided response in our first written questions regarding the impact on specific acre maize. And again, we'd just like to reiterate that within the areas where we're predicting the highest concentrations, the scheme has a beneficial impact on those areas.
Are you proposing to do any more work with the neighbouring authorities?
Yes, I mean, we've, following sort of, you know, consultation with and comments regarding the assessment, we've, particularly relating to the DMRB criteria, we still feel that's the most appropriate guidance to use. DMRB is the assessment of road, of guidance that we use for the assessment of road schemes. But we have looked at a number of receptors on lower road that don't trigger the guidance, don't trigger that criteria, and we've modelled those receptors, and we can provide that information to the boroughs to show that actually the scheme in those locations, the scheme impact in those locations have an imperceptible impact, so we can provide that information.
Could you provide that to us as well?
Yes.
And explain the context of the information. Thank you, Mr. Pyatt. Okay, thank you. So at the moment we have a possible way forward, but a bit of an impasse as well. I think that might be a fair way to summarise it. Thank you. In that case, can we move on to other interested parties who wish to speak about air quality updates? And we have one request here and one further back, Mr. O'Pick. Okay, we've got three here. Okay, shall we start at this end in that case, because the interested parties here have been very patient. So, Friends of the Earth, thank you.
Thank you, Jenny Bates, for Friends of the Earth. I'll just get one little thing about 20 miles an hour out of the way first, if I may. And I would just add weight that that is definitely something that, you know, we see as beneficial. I'll just read you a very quick sentence and a half from a City of London report, which basically says that NOx emission factors are higher for petrol vehicles over 20 mile an hour drive cycles compared to 30 mile an hour drive cycles, but for diesel vehicles they are lower. And they went on to say that given the higher contribution of diesel vehicles to emissions of NOx, this is a significant result. And they also say that for PM10s, which is the fine particle air pollution, emission factors are lower both for petrol and diesel vehicles over the 20-mile-an-hour drive cycles compared to 30-mile-an-hour drive cycles, the exception being vehicles with engines over 2 litres in size. So I just thought that might be helpful, and I'd be happy to submit the link or the document. Or
yes, please, if you could submit at least the link and preferably a PDF document. And unless it's over 300 pages, we don't need hard copies, thanks.
Thank you. Now to the substantial bit on air pollution. The preface being that we've heard from others about uncertainties in all sorts of things, and from yourselves, the panel, about how uncertainty could affect this. And I've also spoken about how more traffic could end up being attributable to the scheme, how it should maybe end up being more being attributable to the scheme if there was a lower baseline traffic than TfL assume. So that's a sort of background to that. And now I would just going to read you a couple of lines of something which may be of interest. And this is saying that there's been adopted a particular interpretation of EU guidance which basically allows air quality to get worse provided it is no worse than the worst link in the zone, which I think you know in air quality terms, the zone in our case is London. And then this passage goes on. It says, as a basic approach, we would disagree with their interpretation of the guidance that they have adopted. Now, that sounds like my words, because that's actually what I agree with. This is referring to the National Network's NPS, this test in 513, which is, as I've just read, basically saying that allows air pollution to get worse as long as it isn't worse than the worst place in the zone, as long as elsewhere is even worse. Now, those words were not said by me. They were said by Transport for London's Richard de Cayney. So that was TfL's own view that this National Network's NPS test was, TfL disagreed with this. And the words were said in the Environmental Audit Committee inquiry into Heathrow. So Transport for London had that opinion on that test at Heathrow, and yet here in the Silvertown Tunnel and elsewhere, they have relied on the test and they refer to the test. I would first of all just say that not only did we agree with this on Heathrow, but the Environmental Audit Committee in their subsequent report on that, they considered that test inappropriate. I could furnish you with the actual words that were in the report, but essentially that was what they came to the view. And also, one of your colleagues, a planning inspector, who investigated the London plan, some parking restriction relaxation plans, actually came out with the view that on our side, that it wasn't okay to worsen air pollution just because somewhere else was even worse. So we have a precedent from one of your colleagues on this, and again, I could furnish both of those points. And in that case, the mayor was required to take other measures additional to what would otherwise be required to ensure that there wasn't any worsening. You're recommended a requirement. You're absolutely right, sir. So that's a sort of background. And I would just say that the Client Earth judgment, the recent ruling, which you're aware of and referred to, which dates from the 2nd of November, that has added further clarity to the idea that this test is not appropriate. We always felt it was before, but this has been absolutely clear now. And I'm sure you understand that you're of the view too that the Client Earth judgment is relevant and material to take into account to against the National Network's NPS. And the relevant bit is about exposure reduction. And essentially, I'll just read you the one half a sentence from the conclusions of Mr. Justice Gorham's ruling, which says that the Secretary of State must choose a route to that objective, which is to meet limits ASAP, which reduces exposure as quickly as possible. So, and what that means is that everybody must have their exposure to air pollution reduced everywhere in the zone, across the zone and for everywhere. So it's not okay for anywhere to have it worsened. And that was effectively already the case, that it's not okay to have areas that would have improved air pollution traded off or balanced against areas that would have worsened air pollution. That was already something that was being clarified to Clean Air in London and in a direct memo from the European Commission, I think, that idea of trading off is not appropriate, that is you can't do that. And in the Client Earth judgment now, it's clear that everybody needs exposure reduction, and that directly impacts on this National Network's NPS test. In other words, it is absolutely clear now that you cannot worsen air just because somewhere else in the zone is even worse. You can't sort of hide under a worse place, as it were. However, TfL are still referring and appear to be relying on this, referring to delayed, how it's, the scheme is not going to delay compliance of the London Air Quality Zone, both in their response to your, R17? What is the word for that? Rule 17, my shorthand. Rule 17, I refer you to what paragraph 1.4.4 and 1.4.5, and in their recent updated air quality and health assessment, which is document 833 or 833, and in that document it's paragraph, you could see that in paragraph 2.5.5. So the test needs to be, not only has it always been absolutely clear under EU rules that you cannot cause a new breach, that is the clearest, strongest thing, but it also that you can't worsen air pollution where it's already over limits. And that means whether or not it delays compliance. So I think for me that the this is where we get into a couple of uncertainties. And for me, the question is, where Transport for London refer in their transport assessment, and I refer you to paragraph 7.3.66, this is where they refer to the release of congestion, in other words, this congestion redistribution from areas immediately either side of the current Blackwall Tunnel, which we know is, you know, a problem, effectively redistributing this congestion to areas quite a bit, which could be quite a bit further north and south. In other words, the next places that traffic that would get through the cross the river quicker, the next places that traffic would get held up at. Now, what I am not clear on, and I don't know whether the panel is and needs to clarify this, are all those possible places where they acknowledge there would be redistributed congestion included in the air quality study area? Are they all captured by the receptors? Are they all in there? One would hope so, but I'm not able to be clear on that myself, and I don't know whether the panel is. So that is one question uncertainty. But even on what they show, what they have shown is that there is at least one large worsening, and on the basis that there is the two parallel systems of one being objectives and the other being the EU limit values, that the large worsening appears under the sort of objective heading, and therefore they can say, and they do discount that in terms of EU compliance, but it's very clear there is, you know, at least one large worsening. However, there is also, for EU compliance, one place in their table, which was, I will come to that. I didn't make a note of that. I better just tell you the table I'm looking at, which was, I can do that very quickly, which was table 2.8 in the document 833, updated air quality and health assessment. There was one place where there would be a 0.3 concentration worsening, and that is the number, the reference number for that was, there are two numbers, a TFL number and a DEFRA number, 4818 for TFL and 75427 for DEFRA, where they say it would go from 39.8 with an increase of 0.3 to 40.1, whereas the legal limit is 40. So they are saying that would be going to over the EU limit with a 0.3 increase. But they are effectively seem to be saying that is not significant, that is not important, that is not relevant. It's not clear, but you know, we're clear that is, you know, that should not be allowed, that is you know, a key, you know, material change. And there are others, there are at least two others that were very close. You know, there was an increase and others coming, you know, coming really close to either to going over the limit or to being close to actually adding, you know, adding to the level. And I would just remind you at this point that, of course, if there was more air pollution impact attributable to the scheme, which is what I've referred to before, if there was more attributable, all of those amounts could be higher amounts. The 0.3 could be quite a lot more. The others, there could be several others that could be more. So that's why the attributable bit is really important. Now this gets me to another uncertainty, but we, as we know, already what TfL have said is that the that DEFRA are going to, following the Client Earth case, that DEFRA have to redo their PCM model, and what TfL have been clear in their Rule 17 response was that they then have to add their local modelling to DEFRA's work, and that's when they can reassess the EU compliance, as I understand it. And obviously for DEFRA's new work, there would be a much worse baseline because it'd be on less optimistic assumptions, though more action would be required. So how those two balance each other out is uncertain. But
Miss Bates, yeah. A lot of these points you could give to us in writing, and we're aware
I'm
of
I'm just
them.
At the
if
end.
You could summarise, thank you.
Yeah, I'm just coming to the end. Okay, so...
Just ask, when you do come to the end, can you just go back over that one, those references that you gave to the one exceedance? Cause
yes, shall I do that first of all? The reference numbers, would that help, sir? Yeah. It was table 2.8 in the new updated air quality assessment, and it was reference number 4818 under the TfL heading and 75427 under the DEFRA heading, and it was going from 39.8 with a plus 0.3 increase to 40.1. Okay. So this is the, to me, absolutely crucial thing here, and I'm sorry, I do need to say this rather than just write it down, because what TfL are proposing, as you would have seen in their Rule 17 response at 1.4.4 and in the 8.33 document, the updated air document, at table 2.13, table 2.13 in the section relevant to 5.13 of the NPS, what they are basically saying is that it's all right, the assessment would be redone when just prior to scheme opening, and trying to give a sort of positive spin on the fact that it's great that we would have flexible charging because then we could sort this all out. But prior to opening, the scheme will presumably have been partly built or built, and what would happen? What could possibly be done at that point if it had been shown, if it shows that there was actually something which should have made it absolutely clear that the scheme should be rejected? So basically, if there was any worsening of air where it was already over or a new breach, the scheme should never have been allowed. So if that was shown, would the whole thing be then demolished? You know, I mean, it's not a question of mitigation. It's the fact that it should never have been allowed to be built. And because we don't know that, we cannot know that, we cannot, in my view, allow recommendations for approval to go forward, for the Secretary of State to approve it, and for them to be allowed to build it. The precautionary principle requires that we must reject this now, as TfL have not themselves chosen to postpone their procedure, as they could have done when the DEFRA requirements were clearly needed. So I think that's pretty much. And I, very final last thing, I know that TfL are saying that we've already uplifted our assessment, but as I understood that was their part of the assessment. Now, perhaps somebody, they may be able to clarify that was, I don't think that they were saying that DEFRA's own assessment that they would add to theirs was also already uplifted in their calculation. So, you know, is it just their assessment that's been uplifted that would then have to be added to the DEFRA PCM? or are they actually trying to say that the whole PCM, everything is already uplifted? But either way, there's so many uncertainties and unclarities, and so, as been said, so much can change from such a little change in traffic. So I think I've more or less got there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bates. We'd be grateful if you could put your summary in writing to us at deadline 3, yes. And then the applicant would be able to pick up on any points that emerge at deadline 4.
Madam, we ought to, I'm afraid, quite complex legal submissions, I ought to say something about them, I'm afraid, and I'm, you know, I know the time is not great. Could
we have a break? Because we have four other interested parties that want to speak about this.
Yes, I'm keen that you have our perspective, can I put it like this, on some of these points, but I'm more than happy to do that after the break.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. When we come back and re-adjourn, we will start with your response then. And then if the Toblerones could be left in situ, and we apologise that we can't take them now, but we feel that we ought to break now until it's 1:50 on that clock, so 2:50 on that clock. So everybody's got time to go and get something for lunch. Thank you very much, and see you in an hour's time, or just under an hour.